while butter my biscuits. Finally, these two yahoos trampling over my lawn have gotten around to talking about the real hero of this story, me. Time for another story, and another trip through the wind door. Brief prologue. I originally said both in part one of this episode and in the show notes that we were only covering chapters 10 through 12 this time around. However, it was only after the edit was done that I became aware of how much we covered subjects that were in chapter 13, specifically as regards conversations of Mayor Buck. So I will say now that even though we are going to go into much greater detail regarding chapter 13 in our following episode, you should read it now if you want to avoid being spoiled. So, let's now delve into something that's a little less heavy. Our experience with the strange old man from the very chapter titled The Old Timer. I think you had a term for this gentleman that I is not familiar to me. Old Man McGucket.
Have you watched Gravity Falls yet?
Oh, okay. Yes. Yes, I have watched Gravity Falls. I had forgotten that's what his name was. So for those of you that are not familiar, first of all, Gravity Falls is a Disney cartoon that came out, I believe, in 2012. And in very brief, if you really want to know more about Gravity Falls, go check out the School of Movies podcast on episodes 1 through 6 of season 1 of Gravity Falls. It's a hoot. And well, probably watch the show yourself if you're curious at all. But just to give you an idea of what we're talking, it's basically the idea of if like the X-Files and maybe a little bit of Twin Peaks as well was introduced to, you know, cartoon youngsters, because they're coming to this small town in the middle of nowhere, and there appears to be a lot of unusual things going on, like monsters or spells or strange books with arcane legends in them, treasure maps, bottomless pits that are actually bottomless, just a lot of weird stuff like that. And it goes off in serious directions, and it goes off in kooky directions. And one of those kooky directions is an old, you know, your standard, when you picture a crazy old man with like the floppy hat and the huge bushy white beard, and maybe he doesn't have a whole lot of teeth in his mouth, and he goes off on weird tangents talking about crazy stories. That's
I've seen him again.
Yes, he is a complete stereotype, but a lovable stereotype. And even though he is not a main character in the story, he shows up again and again in various unusual circumstances to add color or, you know, actual plot to whatever story is going on here. And because that's a cartoon, there is obviously, you know, he is meant to be sort of a ridiculous character. But even in a children's cartoon, there are times when it seems like he is more serious or knows more about things than he is at first willing to let on. That, like, mm-hmm. He is not just this weird comic relief character. And while for the most part, when we experience Malloy in this story, and he's telling all of these weird stories to our heroes, to the collection of James, Abigail, Frank, and Annie. And Annie is certainly, she is giving him her full attention, seeming by all means to be, like, interested in what he has to say and willing to take it down. Because goodness knows, maybe these weird stories do pan out, and we learn more about the fact that there are weirder things in the world. Like, already the Wendigo are here, so what else is out there? Maybe we need to start paying attention to stories about the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot or whatever. That doesn't change the fact that
I saw a Mothman.
I saw a Mothman, and that's just sort of like, already, I can imagine an 8 foot tall or 10 foot tall ape man or just hairy man living out in the woods, but, you know, we start getting into the realm of Mothman, then we start thinking about Mothra or like just weird, like the owlbear, the dog snake, weird combinations of creatures that you find hard to necessarily take seriously. And that's, so on some level, that's definitely how Malloy feels. I keep wanting to call him Old Man McGucket. His name is actually...
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, because I'm reading your notes here. That's the name that keeps on popping up on the screen.
He's definitely meant to sort of, like, elicit that kind of image in your head, especially with the sort of missing teeth and his sort of crazy... He's deliberately sort of almost like leaning into knowingly, like, the fact that these people are probably sort of dismissing him, so he kind of has a bit of fun with them, like a, you know, would I not look like the prettiest thing in town with a white tiger skin?
Oh yeah, no, it's that. There's definitely that element going on there, but the book itself sort of leads on to suggest, hey, we have a lot of fun here in secret rooms, but maybe you should actually consider that he is not a complete kook, as he gets this far-off look and serious tone in his voice that the book makes a point of, like, pointing a finger at and saying, okay, so, you know, maybe you should think about some of the things he said here, even if it sounds ridiculous. For those of you that have looked at the roster of potential books that you're going to read while getting into New Century, you may have come across a particular cover where very prominently on the cover are a bunch of what look like tigers. So the very idea that Malloy is discussing that his son saw a white tiger in the woods, let's just say
completely unrelated.
Yeah, it's completely unrelated. Think no further about it. Clearly, the old man doesn't know what he's talking about.
Why must you be so interested in my forbidden cupboard of secrets?
That's a humorous aside, but also an intriguing aside. It's not wrong to say that the words that Malloy uses when he's talking about, you know, things waking up and they're not inclined to go back to bed again, That is, again, hinting at a major theme or thesis of New Century. As a result of these unusual events that have caused the Wendigo to significantly divert the path of history, hold on to your hat, because there are more things in heaven on earth than are dreamt of in your philosophies. There's going to be more of that.
Speaking of Shakespeare, I would say that Malloy absolutely, with this little tidbit of wisdom, comes across almost like the concept of the Shakespearean fool, that character who seems to be completely, like, you dismiss because he seems like a moron, or not a moron, but he seems eccentric, and he seems to be, like, you know, there to kind of raise a laugh out of you, and then every now and then he kind of uses the way that you dismiss him to present some bit of wisdom. Shoot, this goes actually on the money about this, and it's a way of making the salient points hit all the harder, because they contrast so much with the foolishness that they present the rest of the time, and with the sense that there are things which have woken up, and now that they're not going back again, it really does emphasize the notion that we can't go back, that these are the consequences, and whatever the world was before, it's never going back again.
Yeah. As things progress in the story and our heroes do our best to deal with the things that go bump in the night and trying to bring their world, whether it's America or elsewhere in the world, back to some semblance of not necessarily normality, because as you said, that's never going to happen again, but some semblance of stability. This has happened. You can't put the stuff back in the box. And that's all I'm going to say about that, because not being able to put things back in boxes, that's going to show up later on. I won't say
it might be a talking point.
Oh goodness, we're the worst podcasters ever, because we keep on it's a book called Secret Rooms, and we can't keep a secret for shit. I mean, even just the fact that we're revealing that there is a secret.
We're a discussion group, and we're talking about all the things we can't discuss.
Yeah. We can't discuss now, but don't worry. There's plenty more podcasts to come, and we'll discuss it all eventually. Just trying not to spoil it too much for those of you that have not read it yet. All right, so now we're heading back into slightly heavier territory again as we get into Chapter 12. And discovering that Abigail's childhood town of Clearwater is now re-inhabited by not the people that she grew up with or her family or anything like that, but a collection of not just one group of settlers, but like two groups that ostensibly combined forces in order to look out for each other, have taken over Clearwater and renamed it New Athens.
It's like the most dramatic example of when you come back to your hometown after some years have passed and there's not a single shop that you recognize.
Yeah.
Please pick up. It's Martin Blank. I'm standing where my living room was, and it's not here because my house is gone and it's an Ultimart.
You can never go home again, Oatman. But I guess you can shop there.
No, I can definitely see that aspect to it. But in particular, something I didn't think too heavily about the first time, and then once we were starting reviewing these chapters in earnest, specifically the further importance of names. I don't remember where I first heard Alex say in the roundtables that a name was picked for this reason or another. But given what we've already talked about in terms of the ship names, the first name of Abigail's father, and something that Loretta mentioned regarding the meaning of one of her characters' names, it's worth looking into these things and figuring out if Alex hid some secret subtext in there. By the way, after episode 8 aired, Alex shared that the Ismalia was an actual historical ship, and one that apparently disappeared in the Atlantic and in 1873. Sometimes coincidence happens. Alex and Sharon talk about movies that show moments of brilliance that was entirely unintended by the creators. What I have learned from conversations with Alex is that most of the time, what he did was entirely intended, and the rest of the time, he'll give me that little wizard smile, and I'll never know for certain. There is, in fact, a New Athens in Illinois, which is not where they are. They're further south than that. Just looking at the history a little bit, I found it interesting because it was ostensibly a smaller town that was originally, when it got bigger, the people that were significant for building the town up were apparently notorious counterfeiters. I don't think that that's what Alex was alluding to in this. It's probably more along the lines of, you know, just like we have New York and New Hampshire and all that sort of thing like that, you know, drawing on a new as being something that we just title places as being an aspect of it. Then again, we already have a Greek reference in the name of Hector Gray, so who knows? Only Alex. It's interesting that they even bothered to come up with a name for the place, but then again, they probably didn't have a sign outside of town saying, you know, Clearwater, population 10,000, 5,000, more of them are Wendigo now, zero. So they needed to call their new settlement a name, so they came up with that. Obviously, the original reference here would be referring to the Athens of Greece, which during ancient times was like one of the major cities of Greece and considered the cradle of civilization, even more than, you know, I don't remember now what the capital of Sparta was. As it turns out, the name of Sparta's capital city was Laconia, made all the more amusing now in that in modern Greece, Laconia is the name of one of its regions, the capital of which is named Sparta. that's a city that most people are aware of, even on the smallest level. So I feel like using that name is attempting to invoke a little bit of, like, who knows how much outside contact the people of New Athens have had with anybody. It seems like, you know, they've had other people come into town. They've got this plan for, like, okay, if you're going to be here, you need to relieve you of your weapons. That's the rule of this encampment, and if you don't like it, you can fucking leave. But the point is that New Athens is the center of their world, so it's the cradle of their civilization, you know, and on a local level, it's pretty much all you can deal with, because communications between settlements and, you know, government and major institutions is all but broken. So the only thing that matters to them are their immediate people and anybody choose to be their immediate people. So
like that, for all intents and purposes, this is the biggest bastion of civilization to them, because, hey, it's civilization. And like, before now, they had nothing. And it also paints a picture in my mind of, if Athens is this city which has been known about and an enduring symbol of civilization for thousands of years, it's like this kind of reminder that human society and human civilization endures, and it's like almost like a promise, a redoubled effort to make sure that this continues to be the case. And if this is going to be the new Athens, then it will last as long as the old Athens.
Well, so this is what they come into, and they end up with a complicated welcome as they are faced down by Sheriff Sampson at first, who is like, okay, who the hell are you? Oh, you can leave now. And then the mayor comes over and is like, no, hold on a second. Why, you're making them leave without even giving them a chance to speak their case or anything like that? And so it becomes this weird power play that our heroes find themselves into. And of course, on some level, you know, Annie and everybody are happy that there's someone that's willing to hear them out, because this is their job and they're trying to, you know, rebuild the nation and do the same thing here as they did in Weirwood and many other places. But the thing is, as things further evolve and we're watching the interactions between these characters now that we know far less of, the mayor and Sampson, as they are having their conversations in front of our heroes, the weird juxtaposition here is that, you know, on some level, we would see the mayor as, okay, he's the one that's talking sense and, you know, working towards a greater whole. So the fact that he's on the side of our hero should be a good thing. But at the same time, he's dropping words like mulatto, which, I mean, first and foremost, are helping to highlight that Sampson is a multiracial character, and as mentioned before, the blackest speaking role thus far in the story. But to be honest, it's a different time, so I can't necessarily speak as to the how they talked back then and what was actually considered offensive. I left this line as a part of the original conversation, specifically to counterpoint that just because white people may not have considered the term offensive doesn't mean it wasn't. The history of the word is complex and is actually Spanish in origin. But one way or another, its existence is a result of colonialism, and often the crimes committed thereof. Mayor Buck using it is a microaggression as much as any other more loaded term. But given what I know of the term mulatto, just the fact that he uses it at all as a way to refer to her rather than sheriff or any other term of respect already makes me leery about him, even before we get into some of the stuff that happens in Chapter 13.
Yeah, and I forget exactly what adjective might have been attached with mulatto, but was it not uppity or something like that?
It was definitely uppity.
Yeah, and that's like the worst cocktail like ever. It's just one of those things like, great, you're the person who's most on side with us. Fantastic.
And, yeah. just, you know, to delve a little bit into it, because he's not, like, I'm not worried about being offensive in regards to the mayor's concern, but in chapter 13, it's all of a sudden revealed that he is not simply racist against black people, he's pretty much racist on against everybody.
Like, I'm an equal opportunity asshole.
Equal, you know, it's just like, this podcast was recorded prior to the murder of George Floyd and others by the cops, and as of the end of August 2020, we have some more violence to add to the pile. I don't ever want to suggest that the bigotry that black people faced was somehow ever equivalent to racial biases like Latino or Asian, religion biases like the Jewish, and especially not those applied to other white immigrants. The show Deadwood was my first experience with the term squarehead, which is apparently denigrating language used to refer to certain German or Scandinavian peoples. Our point is only that even though Mayor Buck's opinion of Mary Sampson is enough for us to dislike him, the story goes out of its way to make him as thoroughly distasteful as possible. And more importantly, that kind of extreme tribalism is not dead and gone even today. Buck is a cautionary tale. The mayor goes on to, like, even before they full-on confront him on it, there is a moment where the mayor is saying, oh, I thank you very much for your doctor being willing to look at those gentlemen even after what they did, even if he is English. And James literally calls him on it as soon as they dive deep into it, where he interjects with, I'm a limey, if that matters. So it's just like, yeah, this... I find myself wondering, what is the cultural background of the mayor to begin with, where he's biased against Irish people and British people? Like, I don't even know. Is he Italian? No, probably not. He doesn't have an Italian. He's just a weird American mutt, I guess, who probably has no idea what his own heritage of. He's just, I'm an American. The last name Buck does appear to be most prominent in the States these days. But its origin is Anglo-Saxon. One can only assume his family might have immigrated close to a century ago, so the only heritage he will claim is American. At the end of the day, the only reason we aren't more worried about him being, quote-unquote, on our side, is that he is essentially a weak character. We're not talking about a charismatic, corrupt asshole like Sheriff Behan in Tombstone. He's closer to the character of E.B. Farnham, the mayor in name only of Deadwood, who is propped up by the power of Al Swearengen. We never see any proof of charisma or ability to command the respect of others like Mary Sampson. He may ostensibly be willing to ally with the goals of the reunified states of America, but for very selfish reasons. Part of the reason why the mayor is looking to make a deal with these representatives of the RSA is he is basically looking for some form of support or backing from
he wants to be recognized as the official of this town.
Because he's not necessarily getting as much support from the other people, especially those that would be far more inclined to follow Samson, because she is a person that engenders respect through her words and through her actions. So, you know, as weaselly as he is, he's never quite, like, as they're calling him on his racism, he's being all like, I have perfectly valid reasons for believing the way I do, and I hope that doesn't mean that we can't work together. He is not strong enough to be able to play his hand any better. He basically has nothing to bargain with except his willingness to work with what he still views as being a more powerful organization, even if he has growing concerns about the fact that there is a black man close to the head of the power pyramid in the RSA. I don't remember off the top of my head how this particular story progresses, but, you know, already when they leave in Chapter 13, there was already the implication that, okay, well, we've got half a feather in our cap and we'll be able to deal with it as it comes, but there's no reason to suggest that we necessarily need to let him maintain any level of power. I mean, they're already going to be writing up their experiences with all of this, and probably including their recommendations. So when other people come along to put up telegraph poles and all the like, it's entirely possible that that difficult, messy situation can perhaps be cleaned up some by other members of the RSA.
Mm.
But I think that's as far as I want to go with that particular topic, except to highlight one specific moment that just felt like a little bit of a lightning bolt when I came across it, because I utterly missed it the first two times that I read this chapter. And it's one of the ones I highlighted in our notes, where Samson and the mayor are specifically having one of their early arguments about whether or not to work with the RSA. And the mayor throws out the line, "Well, it ain't up to you." And that is a direct, dark reflection on the argument that Annie and Abigail had on Elkview Road.
Mm-hmm.
It's significant because, you know, at least during that, Abigail was making some understandable points, you know, from a practicality standpoint, but we could also understand Abby's side of it, and she also ended up being right. It ended up all working out. So naturally, we have an alliance with Annie, even as she's saying, "Well, it ain't up to you," because she is a person of authority, and she's had this sort of thing work. So she knows what she's doing, basically.
Mm.
We trust Annie. At time of recording, I had forgotten that Annie did not use the exact same words as Buck, so the parallel I drew is not precisely hitting the nail on the head. But for all intents and purposes, the sentiment is the same, so the analogy still holds up.
And, like, the tone of the scene with Annie in that firefight is that it does seem like she has this under control, and it's, mm-hmm. like, I think it does feel like, and when Abigail pipes up, it's like, okay, well, this is actually, you're not helping here. So it's like actually a good thing that this is the case. But I think that when that same phrase comes up here, it kind of, it's on the other foot now. It really does show how, for as much as we have seen good people in positions of authority so far in this book with Catherine and Annie and Butler, this is just a kind of indication that there are a lot of places like this in America where there are people throwing their weight around, and unfortunately the far more capable people like Sheriff Sampson are not the people who get to make the decisions, or at least this person is throwing his weight around and assuming that she can't make this decision.
Well, that's he's playing a hand here, basically, saying that, okay, I have the support of some of the people here. Some of them will listen to me because, you know, during a difficult time, anyone who steps up and seems like they have a modest idea of knowing what they're doing, people will follow them. He just wasn't necessarily expecting Samson to have the kind of pull that she did to essentially split the groups back up again. But that you can tie that back a little bit down to racism again, and why would anyone follow a black woman when they have a good upstanding white man to follow like me?
And the narrative shows just how wrong that assumption of his is when like the heroes are assaulted in the bar, and when Samson shows up, the three goons, who, even though they were acting without her instruction, they all really show that they respect her. And when she chastises them, their apologies ring so sincere, and they really sound like that they not only respect her authority but respect her intentions and the fact that she is saying, "You have possibly made this worse for us." They trust her opinion enough to really take that to heart and say, "We're sorry, that was never what we wanted." So it really does emphasize, it achieves two things. One, it shows just how Samson, for as much as she is butting heads with our main characters, she is someone who inspires genuine, not devotion, but genuine inspiration. She is an inspiration to these people, literally inspiring them to act because they thought this was the best way to achieve the things that she inspires in them.
Yeah, they were trying to do what she thought they'd want them to do. They were taking initiative.
Exactly. And I think it also humanizes these goons who really are the sort of hired goons, but they're just the people who seem like they might be a random encounter, but then you have like little moments like when James dislocates one of their shoulders and then puts it back. He's like, the way he's talking is like almost comedic in the way of like, oh, what did you do to me? Like, he's like, he doesn't really care all that much about the fight anymore. And it's just like, oh, just help me, please. And then when he does, it's like, oh, cheers. And it's like, what were we doing again? So that humanizes them. And then when this happens, it kind of does show that for as much as they kind of came in and seemed like they were really putting up an intimidating front, that may have just been a front to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. But something else occurred to me as we were discussing this entire fight. While, you know, a couple of them are given names, and as you say, they are humanized by their dialogue or their actions during the fight, or, you know, with their interactions with Mary Sampson, their race is never gone into. Like, I feel if they were something other than just, like, standard white, that they might have gone into that, and I feel like it would have been significant if the town had three burly black men at its disposal. I mean, that honestly, having just said that a moment ago, that makes me feel a little bit icky to be like, oh yeah, we rely on black men for our muscle to push out unwanted people. That doesn't feel good, even implying that a little bit.
No, but I think that, like, one thing is that even though the book never really goes into it, the fact that the mayor never really goes into it almost sort of implies that they're, like, you feel like he would have mentioned it if the three people causing trouble weren't white.
Yeah. That lends an entire new level to their relationship to Samson, because if three big white men are not only willing to follow Samson, but willing to do things on their behalf in order to anticipate her desires or in order to impress her, that speaks very well of, honestly, them as people to a certain degree, because race isn't as big an issue as the fact that they respect Samson.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's able to command their respect when big, burly white men are the kind of people we imagine when we imagine, like, members of the KKK or white supremacist groups or just general bigots. It's an interesting counterpoint to the whole situation, and it really highlights just how impressive Samson is. Toby went on to point out that this shows there is a changing tide at work that is less isolated than merely what Thomas Arlington has created with the help of President Grant. Completely separate of the RSA, a black woman has managed to gain this level of respect to the point where she very likely leaves with most of, if not more, of the folks than she brought to New Athens. I can't actually speak to the motivations of those that stay. And there well might be considerations other than merely trusting Buck over Samson, because one is a black woman and the other is a white man. Abigail did, after all, ask Annie to be their advocate, someone we know to be very charismatic and charming in her own right. And it may also be possible that more might have stayed if they didn't trust Samson over any newcomer. At the end of the day, the point is this. Mary Samson makes for a formidable foil for our heroes, and we'll go into more of this in the following episode. There are other things to talk about in regards to some of that racial stuff and everything. But again, I think we're going to save the majority of that for next time. There is one last thing that I want to get back to, going back on the timeline a little bit. It happens at the midpoint of Chapter 12, where James and Annie are having a little bit of a heart-to-heart conversation. And
their first one, I think. It's a good... I was thinking of that, how Annie and Abigail have had quite a bit of a relationship up to this point, and James and Butler have, but this is kind of like the first scene they've actually had a chance to talk with one another.
The reason why this particular conversation is important, to draw it out a little bit here, it's combining, like, okay, this is the reason why I said, sure, Abigail, we'll go and see if we can find your former home. I'm going to give this as opportunity for you to test out your leadership skills. We're going to see how you handle yourself under pressure when you're the one that has to make the important decisions. But, you know, also because she understands that this is an open wound on some level for Abigail, and so therefore wants to help heal it for Abigail's sake. And to be honest, also for the sake of the cause. At one point, Annie says to Butler that if Abigail can't manage to handle her rage, that even being a rank-and-file soldier could lead to bad consequences. Abigail has great potential, but it has yet to be tempered and tested in the field. As we will be talking about again and again as we proceed, even after all that they experienced as children, James and Abigail begin the story convinced of their inherent rightness. The beginning of their arc is being disabused of that notion and learning different ways of seeing the world.
What this mission really seems to be is the equivalent of Abigail's loyalty mission. And by that, I...
making a Mass Effect reference there.
As I was going to say, is that to those unfamiliar, in Mass Effect, specifically the second installment in the series, there are these series of missions with each member of the crew that you recruit, who are some of the most important characters in the game. There are these missions which are very specific to each crew member. They are steeped in their backstory. It's some sort of unconcluded business of some sort that before they go on this life or death mission, they really want to kind of tidy up before they go into it. And for Abigail, this is kind of her unconcluded business. This is her thing, which once she does this, she is going to be more engaged with the mission. She's going to be more present. She's not going to be constantly thinking of what's been unsaid or undone.
Toby says this, but as we and longtime fans of the series know, the things unsaid and undone for Abigail and James as well could stun a team of oxen in their tracks and will take far more than one novel to resolve.
That's kind of what I think Annie wanted to do, was she could see that Abigail was going to sort of butt heads against her until she could maybe, like, not only deal with some of her past stuff, but also see what it's like to be in charge for at least once.
Yeah. And so the way that this plays out, the reason why this conversation begins, is because even before the issue of bringing the people of New Athens into the RSA itself can be fully addressed, the point is that one of the primary reasons they came here to begin with is now, without any kind of stamp on it, to be completely resolved, because she doesn't know whether the people that were there are dead, whether her mother and father are dead, or whether they moved on, which is why she's so plaintive about, you know, did anyone leave a note? Is there any indication of anything? It leaves everything completely up in the air. And so Annie and James are having this conversation about what it means to deal with loss on an extended period. Annie is completely frank about, you know, being emotional about all of this. But as she's explaining her process and her experience with James, the thing that stands out to me, particularly on reflection of the story that we just read, not a month ago, where she refers to her pain, her despair, as a beast. So this book was written first, but I feel like, without necessarily knowing it, Alex was basically already starting to talk about the core theme of let them go.
The arc of their two stories have a different timeline, of course. Annie has had a large family, and some of them she lost prior to the outbreak even happening. Rebecca lost Timothy early, and then in short order lost her mother, her father, her sister, her aunt, and the man she loved. Those last three over the course of a single night. The violent nature of the loss cannot be overlooked. Death is never easy to deal with, but violent death includes a level of personal trauma that adds whole new levels of complexity in regards to processing it. But Annie has the added issue of being a soldier, so who knows how many men and women she herself has had to bury along the way. At the end of the day, they are of a similar age and have been losing people all their lives, in ways that most of us will never experience. The only difference is the how of it.
Annie is basically laying that whole thing out for the reader to see, because they use a lot of the, she uses a lot of the same metaphors and just general dialogue about, you know, some go loud and violent, some just crumble quietly, and there's some that just lay down and never wake up again. We're so fragile, James. We can really only take so much. I reckon sadness and despair is just as much the killer as the Wendigo or disease or hunger. She's found a way to let the beast out from time to time, just get her sadness out so that she can deal with it rather than not dealing with it. And, you know, this is something that basically has to happen for her periodically, because a lot of the work that she does and a lot of the decisions she has to make with a clear head. But every now and then she has to have an emotional release. And she completely understands this. Rebecca, as portrayed in the story, is buttoned a little bit more tightly. And it takes the events of Let Them Go to bring them to some sort of climactic release. Unfortunately, she comes out on the other end okay. She survives and, you know, ostensibly she thrives after the end of that story. So it's just very interesting to see the bones of a story that was written like 2 or 3 years later in one of Alex's early works.
I think that the bones that are there because New Century has always been about grief. It's been about like how people survive and find a way to keep going and how they process things. And I will just say as an aside that to anyone listening who hasn't seen The Babadook yet, I would encourage you to do that, because that is very much playing on a lot of these same ideas of letting this monster out and feeding it from time to time, because you have to, otherwise you tear yourself apart from the inside. I think that this scene is kind of key to establishing the tone of this series. James and Annie don't know each other that well to this point. Like I said before, they haven't shared a conversation with one another before, at least not one that has been depicted within the text of this book. And so it really does show how two people, no matter who they are, in this point of time in America, or indeed the world, can come together and share the fact that they have lost someone, because everyone has had to lose someone at this point. It's just like, it's impossible that you haven't. And it's something where even James, someone who up till now has seemed very analytical and not necessarily detached, but finds it difficult to quite grasp the intricate details of other people's and how they react to things. And even he is able to say, how did you, and then he catches himself and he says, how do you manage? And it's that acknowledgement, because he knows that he is continuously managing it. So it is this thing that this scene shows, that it's an ongoing process, and therefore in New Century, it's an ongoing process. It is something which, you know, it's not just a case of one book touches on it and then it's done. It's an ongoing thing where it's explored through these different lenses of these different characters, and they're all looking at one thing, except built up over this sort of intricate sort of weaving tapestry of things. And the experience that Annie talks about here, it comes into play so much in Let Them Go, and it comes so much into the play in other things, which I will talk about at a later date. Just to really sort of stamp on the point of this little tangent, but it really, this scene cuts to the heart of what the series is.
Mm. Obviously, we're going to eventually talk a lot more about James's own grief, particularly when we reveal the events of the second set of flashback chapters coming swiftly to the fore. But listening to our past selves talk about James, I think it is important to point out something in anticipation of those conversations. While I would agree overall that James is some flavor of neurodivergent, neither myself nor Toby actually believe he is without emotions, or that he doesn't understand emotions. Yes, it is a trope of the man that he is partly based on, Sherlock Holmes, that he is a person of logic. But I would not actually say that he is sociopathic or lacking in empathy. If anything, he bears more in common with the alien race of Star Trek, the Vulcans. He does feel things deeply, but chooses not to express them, or tries to focus on things that will allow him to keep those emotions under control. That he feels like the emotions are not useful to him, or even a hindrance. At this point in the timeline, it's an exercise left up to the reader how well he actually manages it. Or, if the way he manages it will not leave him in a bad way for later events.
Again, not to get to dive too deep into things that we will eventually cover in far greater detail later on, one of the powers of New Century in general is that it does a really good job of, like, some of the books in the series are very much focused on just like one or two characters. Tiger's Eye, when we get to it, is very much that kind of story. Secret Rooms would definitely seem to be on some level that kind of story, because based on all of these flashbacks and, you know, who we tend to see the journal entries or the commentaries come from would appear to be just James and Abigail's story. But the important thing to know for now is that, just like the video game that was partly the inspiration for this, as you say, Mass Effect 2,
or indeed the way all the Marvel superheroes have their own films that flesh out primary and secondary characters, only to eventually have them gather into a group,
that a lot of the characters that are introduced along the way get their own significant bite of the story. This is really more of, New Century is really more of an ensemble story than it is necessarily just a collection of protagonists. Or at the very least, protagonist is expanded, because as characters move in and out of the story, where early on we see that Frank has moved on and has gone somewhere else, leaving just Annie with our two protagonists. Eventually, story is going to go into, okay, this is where Frank went, and now he's having his own narrative arc, and Annie will continue to have her own narrative arc. So the things that are being outlined in Secret Rooms now, with these conversations between James and Frank, and James and Annie, and Abigail and Annie, and Tabitha and Annie, should be Tabitha. I just did what you did, Tabitha and Abigail. None of it is going to go to waste, because all of them are going to get more to their story and more development and more of an arc. In storytelling, there are characters that are subjects that act upon the world, and there are objects that are acted upon. And New Century has a lot of subjects. Like there's a cast of thousands, so, you know, some of them are just meant to be there to, you know, add depth to the story or to be foils, and don't necessarily have much of a significance other than, you know, this is the obstacle or this is the person that I'm acting with to get information dumps and all that sort of thing. But the culmination of Steamheart, which is the end of this particular narrative arc, the part one, the the phase one of the new century story is a lot of, a significant number of subjects coming together and trying to fix the world Avengers style. And even as that's going on, other subjects are going on elsewhere trying to deal with things. It gives a very huge world view of it. And I feel like it's stronger for the idea that it's not simply one person that, like, even Mass Effect 2, while you have other characters that you control because they're members of your party and you're going on loyalty quests with them, on some level, it's really the main character that you play, Shepard, is the subject of the story. And other characters inhabit this sort of...
And his name even indicates that he is the literal shepherd that is people together. But in
New Century, there is a lot more depth to what is going on. And in Arlington, for example, you're like, okay, so we're meeting some subjects that we already know, and this is a continuation of their story, but we're also meeting other subjects and learning about the things that they have been having effect on and how these people are working together. So it's I don't necessarily know what a good word for it is, but I just like how Alex puts all of that together and just he shares around the agency a lot. And I feel like that makes for a more compelling story.
There is another term that I've used before, conservation of characters. It's a smaller subtrope of the term conservation of detail. It's basically saying that good storytelling will make it so there is little wasted space when it comes to letting us know the things we need in order to be able to follow the story. In mysteries, it's the unwritten rule that while there may be red herrings along the way, that the audience is given all the information they need to solve it, and that the culprit is someone we have already met on screen. Alex uses this concept differently. When we talk about the Cartographer's Handbook, you'll find along the way that many of the characters in the vignettes will show up one or multiple times over the course of one or more books. Sometimes it will be as simple as it was in Let Them Go, where a character will be mentioned in passing that we had a scene with in an earlier story. They may be largely incidental scenes, but because he is reusing a character we may remember, it makes the world feel more fleshed out and vibrant. For new readers, I will try not to let slip which ones will be important, as I kind of thoroughly have with Rebecca. But you can be sure that I will point them out as they return to affect the plot.
It's collaborative, to be sure. It is very much a case of everything in not too much hinging on any one individual, and I think because of that it really does raise the sort of uncertainty with which, you know, any one character can like be safe or have like, you know, the sense that, well, we have to have this person carry on, otherwise we have no story. It really does bring it to life that much more, because that's kind of how the world and life is that, you know, we're all our own subject, to be honest. And, you know, you'll get some people who you'll be able to dismiss, like the mayor, who is very clearly there to be shallow and just be so set in his ways that he can't really enact much change, because clearly he doesn't have much vested interest in changing things much more than reestablishing what he believed the old world to be like. So you know, he's someone who New Century doesn't have a vested interest in, because he is not someone who is trying to bring that titular New Century to pass. He is not that person who is collaborating, even if he is helping our protagonists. It's in a very sort of self-interested way. And as much as Rebecca has sort of disappeared from our narrative for the time being, you really do see how like her story sets the table for this one, and now we can see the beginnings of other stories which are going to thread off from this one, whether it's from our hintings at Tiger's Eye or how Butler has gone off to act on Arlington. It's all stuff which connects to one another, but not in a way which is like a sort of a tangled mess of spaghetti or something like that. It's much more a, like a jumper. It's just all these threads coming together.
Mm-hmm. I also don't feel like it's giving too much away to suggest that Rebecca will come back into the story. Obviously, Tiger's Eye is a little more complicated because that would require you to have, like, looked up all of the various books on the New Century Multiverse website. But at the very end of Let Them Go, Alex is doing the Marvel Cinematic Universe thing of, you know, this person will return. So, you know, it's a promise. You're going to see her again. We're just not going to tell you when. Their story will come back, and their personal arc will very likely continue. Hearing you talk about this, about it being a collaborative effort, part of me honestly wonders if some of that came about because Alex chose to go beyond simply writing a book and turn this into an audio drama. If you've listened to some of the other voice actors talk about their characters and what they took away from the experience about lending their voices to these characters, you get the very distinct notion, I mean, they even address it a couple of times during these conversations, that their characters were very much shaped by and influenced by the people that gave them voice. Like, if you could almost draw a line between the kinds of characters that tend to be subjects and the kind of characters that tend to be objects, pay attention to, if you can, I mean, I can because I tend to have a good ear for these things, and while Alex can be the man of a thousand voices, and Sharon has definitely done her work in terms of making some of her individual voices distinct, it's the people that Alex has gotten somebody else to lend a voice to that tend to be the ones that have the biggest impact on what's going on. When you hear Malloy talk, that's Alex there. Alex does most of the voices for a lot of what he's written, just in order to keep, you know, complication and overhead down, and because, you know, not everybody is necessarily significant enough that we need to get somebody else to give them a distinct voice. They're here for a moment, they're here to do their thing, and then they're off again. Maybe they're even just some goon that comes in to beat up our protagonists. So, yeah. You know.
And, you know, you get characters like the soldiers that Butler tells to, like, clear out while, you know, he has a private conversation with James, or when the mayor is talking to some sort of toady person who is, like, sniveling and saying, like, oh, right away, sir. It's sort of very, like, you know, these characters who I wonder even really are able to say anything within the book, but they, you know, Alex sort of brings them to as much life as is needed.
Mm-hmm.
By this point, fans of New Century may have listened to several of the roundtable conversations, or even more recently, our interviews with Loretta and Theo on the characters they voiced. By and large, there is an agreement that the experience is very much a collaboration. These characters were created by Alex first, and given life by them. But they do bring their own experiences to the table to inform the acting they do. And sometimes, even the smaller characters actually have an impact because of what those characters bring out in the actors. One could say that it's a natural part of the process, but I would go on to say that it feels like Alex sometimes writes characters specifically for certain people to voice. When you get to hear our interview with Matt Wardle in the coming months, this will be a topic we get into a lot. Some of the characters he voices are just for the fun of it, and others mold very closely to certain aspects of himself and his life experience.
All right. Well, again, good talk, almost all talked out about at this point, which is good because, as mentioned before, there is still a lot more to cover just in Chapter 13 by itself. So we will do that next time. We hope that we've entertained you and given you food for thought, and we hope that we will do so again on our next trip through the Windor.
Take care.
I had originally planned to save this song for much longer down the pike, specifically Steamheart, because the lyrics could apply to several members of the cast of New Century, and not just our current protagonists. But given that we ended up talking a lot about some of those characters now and what they shared, it just felt more and more resonant as I went along. So I will leave you with a recent song by The New Politics called One of Us.
Everybody needs a place to call their home. Everybody needs someone to call their own. Even when you're lonely, no, you're not alone. You're one of us, one of us, one of us, one.
Borrows a great deal from Max Brooks's second book called World War Z, which they made into not a very good movie, unfortunately.
But it has Brad Pitt. It must be so good.
The important part is that regardless if you play male or female, male or female, the two genders. Conversations between Abitha. I'm doing portmanteaus or mispronunciations of everything now.
Abitha is what we call the ship of those two.
Yes, indeed. Oh, wait. Shh. Don't give away too much. Shh.
What are you talking about?
All right. So, a
a White Scarves team up with a It's worth looking into these things and figuring out if Halleck's hid some secrets. Halleck's. Put an H in there in case of some herbs come along. There is a term, I'm going to fail to remember exactly what it is, but there is object, and I forget what the corresponding term is, but it's the kind of meant to be the diametric opposal of object, and that's what protagonists usually are. There are people
subject.
That act on subject. Yes, thank you. If I was doing this by myself, I would be completely lost. Okay, so
not as much as I would be, I assure you.
All right, fair enough. By this point, some listeners may have listened to the New Century. Yeah, because listeners listen. That's what they do. Okay, I'm gonna rewrite that.